Hey everybody, Kelly Nelson here, introducing what is another batch of recordings that I did for the North-South Connection Network and their Chronoso podcast, which looks at WWF shows from the 80s, working their way into the 90s. Most of the stuff I talk about is from 1989, with one match from 1988 right up front. All right, so enjoy. Take care. Later.
With our weapons, we dreadnoughts are unbeatable.
Anyone can use a weapon, but the ninja is a weapon. Behold!
Not so tough. Blimey. An impressive display
of the ninja's power, yes.
Hey, Kelly Nelson here as a last second substitute to talk to you about the Ultimate Warrior versus the Super Ninja? Super Ninja 1? Who the hell is this guy? So, it's an Intercontinental title match. The Warrior, of course, is the champion. Not sure what Super Ninja 1 did deserve a title match, because this is his first match in the territory. Or is it? Get into that in a bit. Mr. Fuji is Super Ninja 1's manager. I think I'm just going to call him Super Ninja. In the pre-match interviews, it was Mean Gene who added the 1, which raises the question, where is Super Ninja 2? It's interesting. It suggests, you know, it's like your typical mass tag team where you have number one and number two. But no, this is the first and only appearance of Super Ninja 1. And unfortunately, we never get to see Super Ninja 2. We can only, you know, dream of matches that they may have had between the Conquistadors, you know, mask versus mask matches, like it's Mexico or something. Anyway, so we have the interviews pre-match, and Mean Gene is here with Fuji and the Super Ninja. As I said, this is going to be a match for the Intercontinental title. I'm assuming Mr. Fuji, you know, maybe greased the palm of President Jack Tunney to lend more credence to those who think that Tunney was corrupt, because, you know, this guy just strolls in and gets an icy title shot off the street on Saturday night's main event, no less. Something is fishy here. Then we get the Ultimate Warrior for an interview with Gene, and it's pretty tame and unnoteworthy as far as Ultimate Warrior promos go. You know, nothing that would become a meme later, or that, you know, you'd throw up on Twitter or something. Hey, look at this crazy coked out Warrior promo from the 80s. No, this is pretty forgettable stuff. So we get the match. The Ninja comes down to some pretty upbeat music. Not exactly music suggesting a bad guy or suggesting a ninja. You know, ninjas in the 80s were pretty damn cool, you know, in movies and comic books and stuff. But this ninja is not cool, though he does have a very cool-looking mask, I must say. You know, it's not cheaply made or anything. It looks like, you know, some money was put into it. But other than that, yeah, his in-ring isn't cool, that's for sure. You know, he starts off hot, comes in with chops and kicks on the Warrior, but the Warrior, of course, no-sells them, and then proceeds to basically beat the tar out of the Ninja It's a quick squash, a couple minutes at most. Yeah, as long as the promos before the match, maybe even not as long as those. But yeah, you wanted the Warrior to look strong, of course. He's the IC champ. Build him up. Destroy this super ninja. Not so super after all. So that's it, folks. What else can I tell you? Well, let's take off the mask. Let's take off the super ninja's mask and see who was underneath. It was Rip Oliver. Now, Rip Oliver, maybe that's a name you've heard of, maybe it's not. He didn't make his mark in the WWF or WCW, for example, on a big stage. But he was a wrestler for quite a few years in the 70s and 80s. And yeah, let's look into his career, shall we? So he was born in 1952, I believe. And he became a wrestler around 1975. That's the first date that I found for him. And he wrestled mostly in the South in the late 70s. But then in 1980, he got to come back to his hometown. His hometown was Portland, Oregon. And he came to the Portland wrestling territory in 1980, which, if you know your history, was pretty hot at that time. This was the peak of Buddy Rose as the top heel with his army, and Rip Oliver would join that army. He would join up with Buddy Rose, and they would run roughshod through the territory for quite a few years. It's somewhat confusing because earlier in 1980, Buddy had a member of his army that was also named Rip. That was Rip Rogers. So now he had Rip Oliver in his army. So it's a bit confusing. There was two Rips in Portland, two heel Rips in Portland. They both kind of had, I think, like blonde hair, long blonde hair and a beard. So they even, you know, resembled each other facially. Anyway, so like I said, he was part of Buddy Rose's army in Portland for a long time. Eventually in 1983, though, they do the big babyface turn for Buddy Rose after years and years of him being a heel in the territory. And it all comes at the hands of Rip Oliver turning on him and taking over Rose's army, and it becomes Rip Oliver's army. And at this point, it included the Dynamite Kid and some other guys. Some good stuff there. Rose's babyface turn is amazing. Everyone should check that out. It should be on YouTube still. And yeah, the reaction of the fans after when Rose turns babyface is just great, because this is the first time they've seen Rose as a babyface in the territory after like 7 years, and the fans just go crazy and swarm the ring and celebrate with Buddy. Anyway, Rip would remain basically, you know, not too far from Portland for the rest of his wrestling career. He would do some work in Mid-South, UWF, in World Class down in Dallas, but mostly in Portland. But he did have a bit of time in the WWF, and that's why we're talking about him today. So it looks like it was around August 1987 where he began like an on-and-off run as a JTTS, Jobber to the Stars, in New York, and wrestled under the Rip Oliver name, and had quite a lot of work from like August 87 to January of 88. And then it dried up to nothing. Basically, he would have one more match in Portland, I think in September, when the WWF was in town. And then he would have this match under a hood as the Super Ninja. And this would turn out to be his final match in the WWF. And another note, this match between the Warrior and Super Ninja was surprisingly the Ultimate Warrior's first Saturday Night's main event match, which is interesting considering he'd been in the territory for about a year and a half or so by this point, but he hadn't made it on TV or on Saturday Night's main event, in a match anyway. I think he'd been in a like he was in a run-in or he came to the rescue of Jim Duggan on an earlier episode of Saturday Night's Main Event, but this was his first match. Anyway, just a little bit more on Rip. Yeah, this was it for him in the WWF, and he would only wrestle until 1991. At least that's the last dates that wrestling data has for him. He wasn't even 40 yet. So I meant to look this up, but I forgot. I was wondering if I could find out some info why he retired relatively young. Like, for a wrestler, retiring before you're 40 is almost unheard of. But yeah, his career ended almost simultaneously with the Portland territory itself, which only lasted until 1992. And one last note, yes, Rip here was the Super Ninja, and I'm wondering if he had brought with him the mask, the cool-looking mask of the Super Ninja. I wonder if this was his that he owned, because looking at his records on wrestling data, in 1978 in the Florida territory, Rip wrestled as the Samurai briefly for a few months, and I'm presuming that he wore a mask. You know, when you have a name like that, that suggests, yeah, you're a masked wrestler. So I'm wondering if this Super Ninja mask that he had here against the Warrior in Saturday Night's Main Event was actually his mask from his brief time as the Samurai in Florida in 1978. One can only wonder. The mask did look pretty new and modern looking, though, the Super Ninja mask. So I don't know if that would have been a mask that survived, you know, 10 years or was first made in the 70s. I don't know. It didn't look like it. But anyway, just a theory. And yeah, well, looks like I've made it to 10 minutes somehow talking about this match. Good for me. Anyway, peace. I'm out. Hey everybody, Kelly Nelson here. Happy New Year from the Great White North. And I'm here to talk about the first match of this Madison Square Garden show from March 18th, 1989. And it's a doozy. The Conquistadors versus the Young Stallions. And I'm not sure if we would have, Marty Sleaze and I would have talked about this match on our old podcast Tag Teams Back Again. I like to think we would have, because if nothing else, the Conquistadors mix two of my favorite things, and that's old-fashioned masked wrestlers and jobbers. But to be fair, they were more like jobbers to the stars than outright jobbers. The Conquistadors are introduced by Finkel as from Parts Unknown, which, you know, maybe I'll just take a wild guess and say they were from Spain. You know, I don't know. Anyway, not much of a reaction for the Young Stallions, despite having kick-ass entrance music, which was Crank It Up by Jimmy Hart from Pile Driver, the wrestling album 2. And they used that beginning in 1987 when the album came out. There was some angle. I think it was meant to be for the Hart Foundation, which Jimmy Hart managed, and somehow the Young Stallions were able to snag the rights. I can't remember exactly the particulars. Anyway, on commentary, we have Tony Schiavone and Lord Alfred Hayes. And this was Tony's first MSG show as commentator. It may have even been his first night in the WWF after coming over from WCW. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it's right at the beginning of Tony's run here as a play-by-play guy, and he was actually really good. I mean, he was always good in WCW, except for, you know, the dark end of WCW in the late 90s. But here in the WWF, he fit right in, I thought, and always did a really good job. So back to the teams here. we have the conquistadors who were, of course, under those masks, Jose Luis Rivera and Jose Estrada, two longtime enhancement talents, jobbers to the stars in New York, in the WWF. And yeah, these teams probably worked against each other a lot. And I checked, yes, they did, as early as December 1987, about a month after the Conquistadors started as a team. The Young Stallions started just after WrestleMania 3, I believe, teaming regularly. And then it wasn't until about August or September that they got the name the Young Stallions finally, and had a bit of a push, beat the Hart Foundation when the Hart Foundation were tag champs in a non-title match on TV. And, you know, it kind of looked like they were going somewhere. But that, of course, didn't happen. A big part of the problem was they just weren't that likable. Paul Roma was definitely made to be a heel. He just has that, you know, an unlikable face. And he would, of course, find success, or at least, you know, success from a quality standpoint with Hercules in 1990-1991 as Power and Glory, a heel tag team. Jim Powers, you know, for me, was basically like an updated Rick McGraw, who was at JTTS with the WWF in the early 80s. You know, just not big enough, had an okay body, but was short. And he's just really boring AF. This match reminded me just how boring he truly was. And this match as a whole is boring AF at the start anyway. And the crowd agrees. We get a loud, boring chant at one point. There's not much going on here. You know, you would never hear boring chants for the Rockers, or for the Hart Foundation, for the Killer Bees, you know, every other babyface tag team from the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. But the Stallions, you know, they just didn't have much going for them. Powers in particular just loved to work the arm in this match. There just wasn't any pizzazz here. Back to the Conquistadors. Watching this match got me thinking, you know, they wear the full bodysuit, full gold bodysuit, and it, you know, I was just wondering, like, how hot was that? It must have been hot having to wrestle in that full bodysuit, no skin exposed, under the bright lights. Their look was basically they were the heirs to the Golden Terror look, if anyone listening knows who that was. The Golden Terror was actually many different men over the years. My favorite, or the one I know the most, is the one from the late 70s in the WWWF. And he was played by Pete Doherty, the Duke of Dorchester. And he was the Golden Terror, managed by Lou Albano. But I think the gimmick went way back to like maybe even the 30s, maybe even earlier in various different territories. There was a Golden Terror in Crockett in the mid-80s. And I think it's almost like a nod to the original Mass Marvel from 1916 and the famous tournament in New York where, you know, it being the Mass Marvel caused this, you know, sensation in the city with people wondering who he was under the mask. And I think, well, that started the masked gimmick in the United States. And the Golden Terror sort of descended from that original Mass Marvel gimmick from 1916. Anyway, back to the match. The crowd does come alive a bit once Roma gets in there playing Face in Peril. And we get at one point a very unheel-like flying body press by one of the Conquistadors for a near fall on Roma, which I thought was funny. Usually you don't see heels do flashy moves, especially back then. Yeah, not today, that's for sure. But back then, you would never see heels, or very rarely would you ever see heels do, yeah, flying body presses, leapfrogs, sunset flips, stuff like that that popped the crowd. So we got a hot tag to Powers, which was medium hot at best, and a House of Fire, which wasn't bad, but the clothesline that he delivered at one point looked weak as hell. And then we get a huge missile dropkick by Roma. He got really good height on this. That hits one of the Conquistadors, and we get the win. The match went about 13 minutes, I believe. The first half, like I said, was pretty slow-paced, pretty boring. We got boring chants. 75% of the match basically was dull. The last 25%, last quarter, was not bad. But this was very much a very typical MSG opening match that, you know, I've seen some horrible ones over the years. Tons of 20-minute draws. Tons of matches featuring boring chants. Tons of matches featuring wrestlers that nobody cared about. This was only slightly better than some of those ones. Anyway, just as I finish up here, I took a look into the records of the two teams because I was thinking as I was watching this match, you know, it's March 1989. I was thinking these guys, neither the Conquistadors or the Young Stallions, I don't think they teamed much after this. Like, I recall them more as a team from like 1987, 1988, and not so much in 1989. And sure enough, I looked up first the Stallions, and they had not teamed much at all since Survivor Series 1988, actually. And they would only team up a few more times. I think maybe 3-4 times total before finally splitting up in the summer of 1989. And there was no angle or anything with the split. They just stopped teaming with each other. They both stayed in the WWF. Roma, of course, went back to singles and would even team with other job guys on TV, but not Jim Powers. And then in 1990, he would get a break and he would turn heel, like I mentioned earlier. Jim Powers would stick around too, doing sort of the same thing, but he never got a break. He just stayed as a job guy, basically, for a few more years, I think. And then the Conquistadors, my beloved mass tag team, this was their penultimate match together, in fact, in the WWF anyway. The very next night in Hartford, Connecticut, against this same team, the Young Stallions, that would be the last match for the Conquistadors in the WWF. Of course, Edge and Christian played the Conquistadors at least once in the late 90s. But yeah, this was it for Estrada and Rivera as the Conquistadors in the WWF. But yeah, and according to wrestling data, and I don't know if this is 100% accurate, this team of Estrada and Rivera as the Conquistadors did wrestle April 26th, 1991 in North Massapequa, New York for the ill-fated UWF, the Herb Abrams UWF. And they wrestled Larry and David Power, who should have been known as Curb Your Enthusiasm. And so I'm not sure 100%. It seems weird that they would only have one match, you know, 2 years later after last teaming as the Conquistadors. But maybe they did. Maybe they had more, and those results just aren't out there. Wrestling data is definitely not perfect. It could have been others, two other wrestlers using the Conquistador gimmick. That, I believe, would happen in the future on indie shows and stuff. But anyway, yeah, so we're seeing the end of an era here. The end of both the Young Stallions and the Conquistadors, basically. Playing out the string in the opening match in Madison Square Garden and delivering like a, at best, 2-star match. Oh, well. So that's it from me. Check out Touchdowns to Turnbuckles with myself and Ryan Gray. Got a couple more episodes left, and then we're done with that. I'm always on Mystery Titans Theater, almost always on Mystery Titans Theater. Check that out on YouTube or on Twitch. And yeah, I'll see you guys later. Some dreams. Hey, everybody. Kelly Nelson here to talk to you about Strike Force versus the Brain Busters, which would end up being one of the more consequential matches from this show, one of the more memorable matches from the show, because you have like a sea of forgettable matches here, but this one had long-term ramifications. So starting off, my first thought was, wow, this would have been a dream match just a year earlier when Strikeforce were the WWF Tag Team Champions and the Brain Busters back in Crockett were the NWA World Tag Team Champions. So you got two former world champion tag teams here, and you have four all-time great workers. Martel and Santana, two all-time great baby faces, and Blanchard and Anderson, two all-time great heels. So really, and this would be, I'm assuming, the only time these two teams wrestled each other. So a once-in-a-lifetime matchup here, literally. So we have no music for the Brain Busters coming to the ring. This was a time when you had some acts had music, some didn't. I'm assuming the Brain Busters never had music in the WWF. I could be wrong, but I'm going to guess that they didn't. Strike Force, of course, comes out to Girls in Cars from 1987's A Pile Driver, the wrestling album 2. Fun music for them. This is their first match together as a team since the previous summer when they did an angle where Martel was injured by Demolition, taking the Demolition Decapitation on the outside of the ring. And they said he had a neck injury from that, but I believe that was worked. Well, obviously he didn't get hurt doing that, but I don't believe Martel was actually injured at all in any way. I think he had to take time off the road to go take care of his wife, who was sick at the time. So that was the end of Strikeforce at that point. Martel returned not too long before this. And this was, I didn't check. I should have. I should have checked to see if they had teamed up prior to WrestleMania 5 on any house shows, Strikeforce. But anyway, this would be their return, and this would be the end of them, as we'll get to. So this match is worked kind of strangely, especially at first. Things go pretty fast. It seems like they're rushing through a bunch of stuff in this. It's just kind of disjointed at first. The Brain Busters, the heels, are cheating within the first minute of the match, which was, I had to chuckle at that. Just great heels. And yeah, there's just like no real time for a build, a slow build to anything in this match, and the psychology is kind of lacking. The crowd is mostly dead, of course, which was a theme for the whole show and had been a theme at the previous year's WrestleMania at the same venue here in Atlantic City. Just no heat. So yeah, things are going pretty fast. Like I said, we get a dueling figure four spot with both Santana, who the figure four for him was sort of his backup finisher, which was a holdover from his feud with Greg the Hammer Valentine. And Rick Martel does the figure four too, which was rare for him. But even this doesn't really pop the crowd. A spot like that should have popped the crowd if this was a real wrestling arena and not this, you know, phony crowd full of people with comp tickets, and just the acoustics were just really poor too. But then things heat up, things change, things get interesting when Tito Santana accidentally absolutely smokes Martel with his flying forearm. Tully ducks. Martel takes the brunt of it and is sent careening to the outside. And at this moment, if you didn't know a turn was coming, this made it pretty obvious. When you have a spot like that where the baby faces miscommunicate, you're going to get a turn. Throughout this, I got to mention Jesse Ventura on commentary putting over the Brain Busters huge in a way that you could tell, like with Rick Rude, with Randy Savage, he personally loved their work. And, you know, he would always praise the workers that he really loved. And Brainbusters get a ton of praise here. They were still relatively new at this time, and they were different, right? They were not your usual WWF tag team, WWF act, in that they were serious, you know, quote-unquote, you know, kind of real wrestlers. And they had the background coming from Crockett, being part of the Four Horsemen, being with Ric Flair and all that. But they fit right in, actually. And this was such a golden age for tag teams in the WWF. They had so many potential partners to take on in the ring. So, yeah, they had a good run here. And now we have Martel on the outside selling the flying forearm for quite a while. Tito's in the ring for a long time here. Can't get out. When he finally gets to the corner to ask for a tag, Martel refuses to tag in. And now this crowd that had been dead finally starts coming alive here with boos for Martel and the way he's behaving. And then Martel eventually just walks away. And we actually get good heat here for the turn, where you can feel the crowd, you know, actually being angry with what's happening before their eyes. You know, Martel betraying his partner. This was rare back then. You didn't have a ton of faces turning heel, I should say, or vice versa. This was at a time when you would get that, you know, once a year maybe. Yeah, so it really had a lot of impact when you had a babyface turn to the dark side. And, you know, Martel walks to the back, and you can feel a buzz in the crowd for quite a few minutes afterwards, you know, where the crowd is realizing what they just witnessed, you know, one of the good guys turning evil. And so that, I found that quite interesting. That really makes up for what had been, you know, kind of a weird start to the match with no heat. But now, with the heel turn, you got something going here. We get a big spine buster from Arn on Tito. Love to see that. The heels, you know, it's funny. They have a two-on-one advantage, but they're still cheating to get over on Tito here, which is great. Even with the advantage, they still have to cheat. And then, you know, Tito has a brief flurry, but he's just, you know, the numbers game, as Michael Cole in present-day WWE, or at least the last time I watched, would use as a cliche, but it's true here. The numbers game does take over. We get the massive spike pile driver from the Brainbusters, which was their finisher, another move I've always loved. Great stuff. Not much of a match, really. It just was a shade under 10 minutes, but it was a great angle. There was a great angle in this, of course. Like I said at the top, long-term ramifications from this, with Martel turning heel, eventually becomes the model Rick Martel, a character I've always loved. You know, he slowly kind of evolves into that with adding the jacket and the perfume, arrogance, and the I am a model button and all that. And he totally gave up his babyface moveset. And that's why a lot of people aren't a big fan of Rick the Model Martel, because you don't get the great matches, quote-unquote great matches, with Martel as a heel, because he deliberately wrestles in such a cowardly, you know, scumbag way. But I love the character, the heel character. It really rejuvenated his career at this point. Having the French accent helped to make him more of a natural heel in the States. Anyway, so this match at least got over Martel as a piece of crap heel for turning on Tito, which was the main objective, of course. And it also got over the Brainbusters as a ruthless up-and-coming team. They would move on post-WrestleMania 5 to challenge for the tag team straps. And of course, in the summer, they would win the tag team straps. So one last thing I have to note about Trump Plaza here, the venue for WrestleMania 5. and four, of course. And it really was, for Strikeforce, it was a cursed venue. You know, at WrestleMania 4, they came in as the tag team champions and they lost to Demolition. So you had that. And then 1 year later, you get the team breaking up, dissolving. So two matches at Trump Plaza for Strikeforce and both turned into nightmare scenarios for that team. And also the Brainbusters are involved in another face team breakup in less than a year. When they were in Crockett in 1988, they were involved in the Lex Luger and Barry Windham team falling apart during a match with them involved, and then led to Windham joining the Four Horsemen, of course. So, yeah, the Brainbusters are such a evil team that their evilness spreads to other wrestlers and infects other wrestlers. And it infected both Rick Martel and Barry Windham in less than a year. So that's all I got. Enjoy the rest of the show, everybody. Take care. Peace. Hey all, it's Kelly Nelson here, and I'm going to be talking to you about the first phase of what would be a really great feud in 1989 WWF between Rugged Ronnie Garvin and Greg the Hammer Valentine. This has always been a personal favorite of mine, so that's why I picked it. And here we go. So I thought I'd do a little background on Garvin and Valentine and any previous encounters they had before this first match I'm going to talk about. So it looks like when Garvin came to the WWF in November of the previous year, his first opponent was Greg Valentine at a house show. And I checked on WrestlingData.com because I was curious to see if these two guys had any kind of a history prior to 1988 and prior to the WWF. And as far as wrestling data goes, the only time they had crossed paths before was way back in 1974 in two battle royals in Florida. So no singles matches prior to November of 1988, but these guys were meant to wrestle each other. Their styles meshed so well. And yeah, there is some televised matches between the two of them from January of 89, so before this feud was kickstarted, one in Boston and one in Philly, and also one at Cops Coliseum in Hamilton. So I'm assuming those are all out there. Well, obviously the Boston and Philly ones are. I think the Cops Coliseum one maybe too, because it was televised. But I've never seen these matches, and now I'm curious to see what they're like, considering how good some of their later matches are. Anyway, for today's purpose, I'm starting with WWF Superstars from April 22nd, and that was taped in Glens Falls, New York, April 4th, I believe, the day after WrestleMania, yeah. Or 2 days after WrestleMania? Jeez, I'm so rusty with my trivia, I don't even remember the dates for Manias anymore. So, yeah, we get a match between Rugged Ronnie Garvin and Greg the Hammer Valentine. And right up front, we got Jesse and Vince on commentary really putting over the matchup huge. You know, that this is going to be a great match, you know, evenly contested, all that. And we do get, I mean, it's a TV match from the time, so it's pretty short, but we get an intense back and forth exchange right away. Chops versus slaps, really great. Reminded me of like something you'd see from Mid-Atlantic Crockett in the 70s and 80s. But like I said, this is short and a cocky Greg the Hammer Valentine is caught with a flash roll-up into a small package as he was going for the figure four and sort of, you know, taking his time and not taking things very seriously here. So Garvin gets the win, and immediately we cut to a Tony Schiavone, who had just started in the WWF not long before this, as a ringside interviewer. I don't remember this
at all, or I don't remember him as a ringside interviewer. I did watch this match. I totally remember this match and the follow-up, watching it. I kind of lost interest in WWF by the summer of 89, but I was definitely watching still here. Anyway, so Schiavone interviews Valentine. Valentine blames the ref for the loss. And then, as he's starting to walk away, then he comes back and impulsively says he's going to put his career on the line for a rematch with Ronnie Garvin the next week. So there we go. That's the start of it. Valentine's saying he's going to put up his career the next week. My only qualm or quibble with this angle, or with this feud, really, is that this first bit is rushed. They on TV anyway, it hadn't been acknowledged that they had any history together. They have one match, a short match. Valentine loses. Seconds later, he's putting up his career, and bang, Garvin responds, puts up his career, and then the very next week we have a retirement match between these two. My quibble is that they could have maybe built this up, you know, maybe for a month or so, to make it not seem so impulsive by Valentine that he's putting up his career. Maybe had Valentine, you know, have it mentioned that he'd been on a losing streak and he was getting frustrated, something like that. Just a little bit more, because they take their time from here on out. This goes on all the way until the Royal Rumble in January. So that's my only little criticism, is the beginning of this was rushed. So here we go. Next week, April 29th, also in Glen Falls, from the April 4th taping, career versus career. Garvin, you know, rather stupidly put his career on the line too. You know, that wasn't like, it didn't have to be. Like, Valentine put his career up, but in the interview, he didn't say, "You have to put your career up too, Garvin." Garvin just did it. You know, I guess he thought he was being some sort of fair babyface, you know, but it's really dumb because he didn't need to. And it would come to bite him in the ass big time here. So we get a lot of near falls in the hammer, though, which was cool. On a sunset flip for one, and then on a flash roll-up, couple two counts, we get the Garvin stomp, finally. Valentine's being totally dominated in this match. This goes maybe slightly longer than the previous week. And then, in a twist of fate or whatever, irony, Valentine is the one who uses the small package for the win here, with a flash small package. But, of course, being the heel, he pulls the tights to get the three count on Garvin. And just like that, Ronnie Garvin's career is over. As a wrestler, he quickly goes back to the dressing room. We get a brief shot of him basically in shame heading back to the dressing room. And then Valentine, again with Schiavone after the match, has an interview. And this time he's gloating. Great heel stuff here from Valentine. So there we have it. And then, like I said, how this things are kind of moving a little fast here. The very next week, that would be May 6th. This was also from Glen Falls, from the taping on April 4th. So we got the first match, we got the retirement match, and then we get this, which is Ronnie Garvin is now a referee. And it's funny, Jesse on commentary immediately criticizes how Garvin became a ref so fast, which is great, because, yeah, it was 1 week in TV time between them. But for the fans watching this live, they would have saw Ronnie be retired and then probably like an hour later come out as a referee. So again, this was fast, him becoming a referee. It makes it seem like anybody can become a ref. But I guess it kind of fits in with like the criticisms of Jack Tunney making biased calls to for baby faces and all that. So this is a match between the Red Rooster and Iron Mike Sharp, where this is Garvin's first match as a referee. And this was, you know, the backdrop here was the Red Rooster versus Bobby Heenan / Brooklyn Brawler feud that had been going on for a while. So the commentary is all about that. A side note, I forgot the Red Rooster used a arm breaker finishing hold that they call the chicken wing. Kind of a unique way to apply it. Didn't remember that. It's a quick win for the Red Rooster, but post-match, Iron Mike Sharp gets in Garvin's face, pushes him, and then Garvin punches him. And this would begin a trend of Garvin getting into it with the heels for the next few months as a referee. coming down often and overruling other referees' decisions when the heel cheated. Several confrontations with wrestlers after the match, heel wrestlers. So next up, we have a big match for TV. The Red Rooster versus the Brooklyn Brawler. I guess maybe the first time they faced each other on TV in a big match, because at WrestleMania, it was Rooster against Bobby Heenan, remember. And this was the May 20th episode of Superstars. It was taped April 26th in Omaha, Nebraska. So Jesse again, and he's been great on commentary all the way through, mocks Garvin for having to get a new job, quote unquote, thanks to the Hammer retiring him. And this was not a bad little match. I'm not here to talk about it. Maybe somebody else is this week. And it's given more time than most Superstars matches from the era, I think. Just a note, Rooster is clearly not very over here as a babyface. There's really no heat. There's a lot of heat for Bobby Heenan, and it shows how great of a heel he was and how over he was, because he gets a big reaction at the end of the match. Garvin kicks off the Brawler's arm from holding the ropes when the Rooster had him for a sunset flip attempt. And that causes the Brawler to lose it. He's distracted. He's in Garvin's face. And the Rooster comes up and rolls him up for a three count. Then, of course, post-match, Brawler attacks Garvin, just like Iron Mark Sharp did. But he gets put away. And Heenan also, you know, almost has a confrontation for Garvin. This is when the heat finally increases. And Heenan makes his patented big jump over the top rope to escape to the outside. And, yeah, so here we go. Next up, June 17th in Duluth, Minnesota. It was taped actually a month earlier in May 17th. This is a match between Bret Hart and Boris Zukov. So this was during Bret's little brief babyface or single babyface run here in 1989. Garvin gives a pretty slow count on Zukov at one point. Bret hits a big pile driver on Zukov and then follows up with an elbow from the second rope, which I guess was his finish at the time, although I think he kind of mixed it up. This was one of the problems with Bret Hart's aborted pushes in 88, 89, that he didn't really have a signature finisher like he would with the sharpshooter 2 years later. And so this is more of Garvin, you know, doing things to benefit the babyfaces, getting it into it with the heels. And then finally we have Dino Bravo versus Brad Perry. And I was a bit lazy this week. I didn't do any research on the career of Brad Perry. I should have, because he picks up a win here. This is July 8th, taped June 6th in Madison, Wisconsin. Superstars again. Bravo, like Bret Hart in the previous match, with a huge pile driver here. He keeps pulling Perry up at the two count of two. So this is starting to piss off Ronnie Garvin. Then he ties Brad Perry into the tree of woe and won't let him out. Won't break with the five count. So Garvin DQs Dino Bravo. We get a rare enhancement talent victory over a pushed star here. I can think of one back in the early 80s. It was Angelo Mosca, actually, was DQ'd in a match for roughing it up with an enhancement talent. I think there was maybe some others, like heels getting counted out, perhaps distracted. Anyway, this was rare. Bravo, of course, pissed off. Big post-match brawl. And yeah, the biggest brawl so far. Other refs have to come in and break it up. And we're going to get to eventually Valentine versus Jimmy Snuka on a Saturday Night's Main Event where Garvin is the referee. And that's the continuation of this angle, this feud. But I'm not talking about that. And I hopefully will be able to talk about a match, because eventually Garvin is reinstated and it's going to come from that Valentine Snuka match. I won't say any more. I don't want to spoil things too much. And then eventually there's a great match between Ronnie Garvin and Greg Valentine from Madison Square Garden from, September of 89 at the Garden that everyone should watch and maybe I'll talk about in a few weeks. So anyways, this was fun. I hadn't watched this stuff in years. Great stuff. Love Greg Valentine, one of my all-time favorite wrestlers. Rugged Ronnie Garvin was pretty cool too. Underrated talent for sure. And yeah, take care, everybody. Peace. I'm out.
your heart, cause I know you got soul. Nothing is this pain. Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm...